Let me introduce our speaker. Andrew, you want to come up here? And I'll put this in your pocket here. Andrew Culp is founder and executive director of the Anvil Academy, an adventure learning academy that challenges, equips, and disciples middle school boys into strong young men. Over the past two decades, Andrew has focused his work on leading and developing learning communities, spanning the gap from middle school boys to middle-aged men. Andrew's professional journey has traveled across classrooms, principal offices, boardrooms, and keynote stages. Andrew is currently leading the Anvil Academy in Cumming, Georgia, and enjoying life as a husband to Katie and father to kids in high school, middle, and elementary communities. He's passionate about supporting and mobilizing men as influence and mentors to the next generation, and came here with the recommendation of Dick Van Eipern. So please welcome Andrew Culp. Just put that right in your pocket.
There you go. Okay, great. Well, thank you. Thank you for the warm introduction. And gentlemen, it's great to be here with you this morning. I've been able to attend several of these. And so, Heinz, thank you for the invitation to come and speak. And as he said, this comes at the recommendation of Dick. So if this goes poorly, you know, we can blame Dick. There's a small group of us here, so perhaps our time can be a bit more conversational rather than presentational. But Heinz invited me to share a little of my story, and I'd like to do that and then offer us something to suggest as men as we leave here, perhaps a challenge, perhaps an invitation. But as I shared, this is our 10th year here in Georgia, and moved down here in 2014, and there really were a few reasons for that. One was professional, and the other was very personal. So as Heinz introduced, education has been my life. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a family of educators. My dad was a biology teacher. My mom was a home ec teacher when we still had home ec. And they moved from central Indiana to Ohio, and then over to Pennsylvania. They kept coming east. And Pennsylvania is where I grew up, and Pennsylvania is where they raised our family as educators. And I come from a family of four. And I remember my dad when he was a really young teacher. And I remember our family being in a crisis, a place of having to figure out direction where Don may know this as being in education. Certainly Dick knows that there came a point where my dad had to make a decision about staying in education and being able to provide for his family of six. And I remember my dad leaving education and going into educational publishing. He believed in the power of education. So he began to go work for Prentice Hall Publishing. You all remember Prentice Hall books and textbooks? So he went and worked for Prentice Hall. And proud of my dad as he had a really successful corporate life at Prentice Hall. But I tell that story because when I was in college and I was trying to figure out what do I want to do, I had a passion for working with younger students. And I remember going to my dad. And at this point, he was president of Prentice Hall North America. And I asked him, I said, okay, I have to make a decision. Do I go into business or do I go into education? And I remember him sitting me down and he said, son, if I could have stayed a teacher, as I look back, if I could have stayed in the classroom, I would have given anything to stay in the classroom. He said, there is no more powerful position in this world than a teacher in a classroom. The ability to influence generations, not through teaching a curriculum, but through a presence of relationship, to be able to pour into the life of a young man or a young woman can not just impact the trajectory of their life, but the trajectory of this next generation. And so he said, son, become a teacher. And he said, become a teacher and change the world. And so I did. I went in and I was an elementary school teacher. I taught third grade in Timberville, Virginia as my first job. Most of the community that I taught worked at the Tyson Poultry Plant, A number of them were migrants who would come in and work seasonally, and then they would go on. And so these kids were coming from poverty. They were coming from homes that didn't have high levels of education. But those parents saw what the kids were getting, and they said, this is the pathway for my kids to have a different life than I had. And we had just a vibrant school community, and they were amazing years teaching third and fourth grade. Then my wife graduated from James Madison University, and we moved to New Jersey, where my parents were and where Katie's family was. It's where Dick was, and this was in Metro New York, right on the Jersey side of the George Washington Bridge, and went into learning communities there, and it was the exact opposite. And so rather than rural impoverished schools, you had suburban affluent schools serving primarily commuters to Wall Street and to Manhattan. And you saw these schools have any and every resource that they could possibly have. But you saw communities that felt empty or felt longing. And it was in the public school space there where I loved teaching and felt that there was value in the work that I was doing. But every holiday, I would go to my in-laws and we'd have an extended family meal. So Christmas and Thanksgiving and Easter. And there was this one man who would be sitting at the table and every year would talk to me about education and try to convince me that there was another way in education. And this was Dick. And Dick hired me out of the public school system into private parochial Christian school in a school called Eastern Christian in New Jersey. And for the next, what I imagine now is 15 years, has served as a mentor, both professionally and personally and spiritually, in my life. And so Dick and I worked together. First, I was the dean of students at this middle school, and Dick was the principal. When he moved on to the director of curriculum and instruction, I had the opportunity to lead that learning community. And as a young administrator, and Don, I appreciate what you had to say, I would have been absolutely lost without a mentor who had walked that path and who cared enough to speak words of encouragement, but also words of critique and criticism in love to allow me to grow into that position. And that's what Dick did and continues to do. But in that role, needing an older man who had gone before and with experience and with wisdom, would some days it would feel like a ball peen hammer would do the work of tapping on my life. Some days it felt like the sledgehammer he'd bring out. But the value of having a mentor, the value of having a wise counsel who would speak truth, soft at times, hard at others, was invaluable. And that's what I want to talk about today as I talk about what I'm doing here. So I came to the same conclusion that my dad did, where at some point, with my four kids and wife, we were living in Metro New York, and so like these numbers don't work anymore. And it was this inflection point where I had to decide, do I go into the corporate sector and leave education and start commuting into the city and being able to make the finances work, or is there another way? And that's where exploring the country, North Metro Atlanta, caught our eye. And my wife had two sisters down here. And we began to look at both the economy down here. We began to look at the schools and the culture. And we said, this is where we want to raise our four kids. And this is where I want to invest my professional best for the rest of my career. Because what we found is, one, I could take about a 25% pay cut to come down here and take about a 50% cost of living cut to live down here. And all of a sudden, the numbers started to work. And that was exciting for me. But the other piece was, we found within the region that there was this amazing educational culture of both high standards within the public sector, but also an acceptance and a willingness to dream outside of the traditional school environment. And so when we looked at the landscape of Forsyth and Cherokee, Fulton counties, the idea of hybrid schools and home schools and alternative schools was a place where I began to think, what if we could dream outside of the box of education? And so we moved down here in 2014. I like to say Dick followed me down here. He's only been here 9 years. I've been here 10. Had nothing to do with his grandkids, had nothing to do with his kids. He followed me down. But over the last 10 years, I've been working here in non-traditional learning communities, asking the question, what does it look like to disciple, train, and lead the next generation of young men who will be leaders in our culture? And so it brings us to what I'm doing now. About 2 miles down the road, there's a small school for middle school boys called the Anvil Academy, where each week 114 sixth, seventh, and eighth graders gather together to have their minds on, but to have their hearts engaged and to get their hands dirty every single day. And I want to share a little bit about the pattern and the process of what we do there, because I'm convinced that what we do with middle school boys is what I also do with middle-aged men. And perhaps as I look out, what I would call masterclass men who have experience and wisdom and so much to pour into this next generation, the life stage is different, but the pattern of formation is the same. And so while I get my hands dirty with 12 and 13-year-olds each day, I think the principles are the same as we think about who are we called to be as men in our stages. And so I want to, you know, I'm a teacher, so I have a quiz for us. Pass these out. I want you to, as a table, figure out who is this founding father. I want you to talk amongst yourselves. This is a famous founding father who was a part of fierce duels and battles that were core to the founding of this country. I wonder if anyone has a guess as to who this man is.
Does he have the same initials as you do?
He doesn't. Different initials. Different initials. Any guesses? Not Hamilton, but he was a colleague of Hamilton. Actually, Alexander Hamilton was a benefactor and supported his work. So he was in a fierce feud with the English, but it didn't have to do with rights or taxation. Didn't have to do with weapons or infantry. He used words. And he's probably the most famous lexiconist, famous wordsmith that America has produced.
Webster.
Noah Webster.
Hey, wow.
Yeah. Noah Webster. So Noah Webster, if you don't know a little of his story, is one of the most revolutionary founding fathers. And if you haven't studied some of his story, I would encourage you to look it up. It's fascinating. But he is in this cohort of the Hamiltons and the Washingtons and the Franklins, the Jeffersons. But he's lesser known not for warring on the battlefield, but warring with words. Because here's what he saw. He was an educator. And he saw, in the midst of revolution, he saw the school children of this country using British textbooks written from a British perspective, using the British version of the English language. And he said to himself, how will we ever spark a revolution if our ideologies and our worldviews are being shaped by our enemy at the time? And so he said, revolution doesn't begin with throwing tea into a harbor. Revolution begins with ideas, and ideas begin with words. And if we can craft and create our own American English language, then we have a chance at true revolution. And so he writes his first American dictionary. And he gets into this feud with a guy named Samuel Johnson. Now, Samuel Johnson was a famous British lexiconist. And so they start having this war of dictionaries. And they start kind of going back and forth between what is the true English language. But Noah Webster, throughout the Revolution, is publishing this American English, which after the Revolution famously publishes his Webster's 1828 dictionary. And I say all that, one, because it's interesting to me, and I challenge you to go look it up. But if you go to Webster's 1828 dictionary and you look up the word anvil, it defines an anvil. It says it's a hard, metal, steadfast shape that things are forged on. But underneath the main literal definition, there is this phrase that in early America was part of the colloquial language where someone would say, I'm on the anvil right now. Mm-hmm. And to be on the anvil, which everyone would have known, means I'm in this place of I'm getting beaten, I'm getting shaped, I'm getting knocked down. I'm in this place of active formation, and I'm not there yet, but my life is on the anvil. And so as we looked out at the educational space and said, where is there the greatest opportunity to do the work of influencing the next generation? We said middle school. Middle school boys, their life is on the anvil. Their life is a place of shaping and formation where nothing is mature. I mean, you guys know middle school boys. Nothing is mature yet. But they're in a place, yeah, of trying to figure out who am I, how am I, how will I get there, where do I want to go? And if you look at the questions of our culture today, the confusion that exists in the middle school age, both with boys and girls, you can look at it and say, this is extremely disheartening. We are in trouble as a nation, which I think is true. And you can say, if there's one place that I'm going to pour in to impact the next generation, it's right here. Because that age group, both from the brain chemistry and the brain science place, the heart malleability is the greatest shaping and trajectory formation place. And so what we said at the Anvil Academy, we were going to try to create a space through adventure, through activity, through danger, through relationship, that we would forge men from boys, that we would create some sort of pathway to end boyhood meaningfully and walk into healthy manhood in a safe, meaningful way. And so that's why we exist at Anvil Academy. And I would certainly invite anyone who wants to come. We love to have guests. We love to have mature, grown men come on campus. So one, that boys can see the model of healthy manhood. But two, they can have access to generational wisdom. And so there's always an open invitation to come. But here's what you'll see when you come. You'll see a process where we use history, science, biblical worldview, physical activity and education, and industrial arts, hands-on carpentry, blacksmithing, animal husbandry. And we use all of that to have an occasion for relationship in the life of these boys where we can help them understand what does it look like to grow into a strong young man. And from our perspective, and this is, I know this isn't a religious gathering, but we say this is what a strong young man looks like. Someone who is able to do the work of Jesus in the way of Jesus. As there's something about the skill and the work that we're called to do and the posture and attitude within which we're called to do it that that we think is core to manhood. And it begins with an anvil. So I heard stories of Midwestern farmers here. And any Midwestern farmer, I'm sure at some point had to work with horseshoes or work with an anvil or do your barn blacksmith. Is anyone here a blacksmith? Has anyone actually blacksmithed before?
I've been
exposed. Yeah. Well, what I'd like to do is in 7 to 10 minutes, just walk through the process of blacksmithing. But the process of blacksmithing, very few of us are going to be called to actually blacksmith, but all of us will be invited to walk through this process in our lives. And to walk out this process in the lives of this next generation. But blacksmithing begins with what?
Heating up the metal.
Heating up the metal. But even before that, even before you heat up the metal, what does a blacksmith need to do?
Build a good fire.
Build a good fire? Absolutely. But even before the fire. You guys remember when Stephen Covey wrote his Seven Habits book 25 years ago, maybe even longer now?
Longer than that,
right? But the principles of that book endure. And one of those principles has stuck with me. I've never been able to forget it. And it's this idea of beginning with the end in mind, right? We begin with the end in mind. And so I love this from a blacksmithing perspective because the raw material that a blacksmith uses, whether it's the steel or whether it's the iron, whatever they're working with, that same material can either be forged into a butter knife or a battle axe. It's the exact same material, but it's the end that the blacksmith has in mind, and it's the process that he takes it through determines what that end product is going to be. And so when I ask the question, what does it mean to forge men? What does it look like to forge healthy men? I think the question is, what's the end we have in mind? What is a healthy man? And if you want to see confusion, ask 100 middle school boys right now, what do you want to be when you grow up? Or what is a healthy man? What do you think the number one goal that middle school boys have right now in terms of what do you want to be when you grow up? It's fascinating. When you were growing up, what was the healthy man that you aspired to be? What would we have said?
Self-sufficient, have money.
Independent, self-sufficient, have money. If you had to say a profession, or what would be the goal when you were growing up and someone said, what do you want to be when you grow up? What would you have said? Pro athlete, a doctor, fireman. You know what? Right now, the top choice for boys when they're asked, what do you want to be? What is a man? A YouTube influencer.
A YouTube influencer.
Really?
Yeah. Above professional ball player, above firefighter or airplane pilot. A YouTube influencer. And so I think that's just, it's interesting to me. I think it's a really interesting diagnostic of what do we value as culture? And is that a strong young man? Is that a strong, healthy man? Certainly there's value in that. But I think the idea that the end that we have in mind influences the pattern that we walk through. And so from there, if we have an end in mind, before we light our fire, what's core to blacksmithing? You need an anvil. I brought these out. I didn't put them on your tables because I didn't want to get dirt and dust and rust all over your tables. These are anvils that have been retired from use at the academy. You can see little bits of them have been chipped away. When they're no longer safe, we retire them. But the process of blacksmithing, if you don't have an anvil, everything else becomes moot. And when we say an anvil, we say, what is going to be the strong, faithful, steadfast object that my life will be shaped upon? And I think one of the hard things in cultures right now, a lot of our kids and a lot of our families don't have a faithful, strong, steadfast model that their life will be shaped against. Yeah. Some try to find it in school. Some try to find it in church. Some try to find it in sports. But you can't blacksmith without an anvil. And so the first question I have for you, men, is what is the anvil in your life? What is the thing that you continue in whatever stage you're in, whatever generation you are, that your life is being shaped against? Because We're all in the process of shaping. We're all in the process of formation. Some are further. Some have been reshaped more than others. But what is going to be the standard? That when your life butts up against that thing, you change, not that thing changes. And unless there is something so secure and so foundational and so faithful and steadfast, immutable, if that doesn't exist, it's no wonder that we're tossed from here and there and everywhere. And so when we work with boys, certainly we have a worldview that we want to teach them in. But when I speak with men, I find that middle-aged men, master-class men, sometimes the further they get along, the harder it is to find that steadfast object that my life will be shaped against. And so the first challenge I have for us, and when I say us at different stages, what will we choose to lay our life upon for the sake of shaping? What is the anvil in your life? The second piece goes to what Steve was saying. So if I'm a blacksmith, I have a strong anvil, and I take a piece of steel, and I put it on the anvil, and I just start banging away at it, what's going to happen? It's going to scuff up the steel.
Yeah.
It's going to vibrate my hand, and there's going to be frustration. And so for the process of blacksmithing to be effective, for the process of formation to actually take shape, what do we need?
Heat.
We need heat. We need fire. I would love for you, I have a gift for you. In front of you is a Zippo lighter. I want you to open it up, and I want you to I filled it up this morning with lighter fluid. Hopefully they'll work. I conditioned the wicks. Go ahead and light it. Hopefully we won't set off the heat alarms. They might take a little bit of time because they're brand new. And I want you to see if you can get a flame. Yeah, since they're brand new, sometimes it takes a little while for the wicks to get conditioned. So fire is absolutely essential in the sake of formation and blacksmithing. A blacksmith forge is firing anywhere between 800 to 1200 degrees. And it's firing in such a way that the actual makeup of the steel is being rearranged and reoriented inside that forge. And when we talk about this idea of formation, we say, unless we are made malleable, that the process of blacksmithing is just frustrating and damaging, unless there is something that makes us malleable to receive the blows. I think one of the hardest things to see is a boy or a man where other people desire change or growth in them, but there is a hardness inside of them. And we talk about this idea of a frustrating process on the anvil is banging cold steel. Shaping a cold man is a really difficult thing to do. And so just like I asked the question, what is your anvil? I'll ask the question for all of us. What is the fire that is keeping us malleable in our lives? What is the thing that I choose to put myself in that is uncomfortable, that feels like it's doing damage to me, that feels like I'm being reoriented or remade, that it's uncomfortable? Imagine the steel, if the steel could talk and it's being put in repeatedly into that flame, what would it say? It would say, I don't desire this. I don't want this. But it's those fires in our lives that make us malleable and make us able to be shaped and changed. And here's what I find. And so I'm 45. The older I get, the more choice I have about stepping into the fire or not. These middle school boys we work with, they don't have a whole lot of choice. Like, they're forced into the fire a lot. But the older I get, the more autonomy I seem to have about whether I will actually put myself into the fire. Because I have more independence, and I have more affluence, and I have more ability to kind of define my life. And I think the more dangerous it gets, where I can become cold and I can become hardened and I can become immalleable. And even a standard that I say, I believe this and I desire this, when I butt up against it, I don't move and I'm rigid because I don't put myself into a fire. And so I'd ask the question, what are the fires in your life? What are the relationships that are uncomfortable? What are the intergenerational relationships that are uncomfortable? Like, I don't understand these middle school kids. I really don't. Like, I try to pretend like I do. There's a lot that I don't get about them. But where will I choose to put myself in relationship for the sake of influence, even when it feels uncomfortable? But take it out of the work world. What about my neighbors? I mean, I see Forsyth County, the demographics are changing like crazy. My two boys are over at Denmark. And you see, Forsyth County, Fulton County, Cherokee County, it looks very different today than it did 10 years ago because you got northerners like me moving in. But you have all sorts of people moving in. Where are we choosing to be uncomfortable for the sake of putting ourselves into a fire so that we can be malleable and we can be shaped against the standard that we say that we believe? So the second question I have is where is the fire that you're choosing to put yourself in? And then finally, you have an anvil, you have malleable steel. What do you need? You need a hammer. The steel can't bang itself, right? It's a pretty simple principle, but it's pretty profound. The steel is placed on the anvil. The steel is placed in the fire. The steel needs somebody to pick up a hammer and shape it into that standard. And here's what I find, too. As I get older and more independent, the less people there naturally are that are going to shape me with a hammer. I have to go and find people like Dick. People who are caring and kind, but skillful and experienced and wise, who I will pick up the hammer and I will give them that hammer and I will ask them to do the shaping in my life. Now, to do that requires trust, vulnerability, danger to the parts of me that I don't want to be seen, I want to hide, that I want to protect. And most days, and I'll use Dick as an example, most days, Dick, I said before, was a gentle shaper of me as a teacher, as an administrator, as a man, as a husband, as a follower of Jesus. And I think to trust someone well is to give them the hammer and say, would you shape me? And a safe shaper will most days be gentle. And it's a long formation. I think one of the things that's funny is in the process of blacksmithing with boys, you know, the boys make weapons. They'll make spears or knives or swords. And a middle school boy is like, when they learn that this is the lesson plan for the day, okay, we're going to be making a knife. They come in and they fire it and they start banging. And they want to walk out that day with a knife that looks like it was on forged in fire. What they don't realize is that process to make that knife is going to take about 6 weeks. Wow. I want to make my knife in 60 minutes, and it's a process of 6 weeks. And so I think we understand a little bit more about patient process and the long formation. And so when I invite someone to be the hammer in my life, I say, would you do the work of long formation? And most days it's those small ball peen taps. But there are times for the steel to take the shape that the blacksmith has in mind. The small taps are insufficient. And it takes the 10-pound hammer to come and give several powerful blows to reorient the core of that steel into the way of the anvil. And so my two questions for you are one, at your stage of life, who have you given a hammer to? Who is actively shaping you? I think it gets harder and harder to find the older we get. And it takes more and more intention to go and seek someone out to give them a hammer. But here's my invitation to you. Who are you actively hammering? Who are you choosing to do the active work in formation in your life? Perhaps it's a son or daughter. Perhaps it's a grandson and granddaughter. It's somebody from a faith community. It's somebody from a professional community. But here's what I see anecdotally that's backed up by data. The minute that we stop actively hammering in someone's life and actively doing that work of formation, our decline happens pretty fast. All the Blue Zone data would tell you the same thing. That when we're not both actively being shaped and actively shaping others, that's when we begin to shift in our vitality, in our purpose, in our longevity. And I speak to myself as the middle-aged man. I speak to these boys as middle school boys, but I offer this suggestion to us as master class men with wisdom and experience and independence, but so much to offer in the way of formation and shaping. And so I'll end with those three questions. One, what is the anvil that you are elevating to be your standard? What's the fire that you are purposely stepping into each day to remain malleable? Who is shaping you? And who will you choose to shape with purpose each day? If you're looking for that purpose, I got a place for you. And it's only 2 miles away. And there are 114 middle school boys who want so badly to be strong young men. And maybe they don't even know that they want that, but they want that. And they're looking for men who will say, I want to be a part of that. So if you want to talk more about that, I'd love to. You can take my card, my contact information. Please take this lighter as a reminder to remain malleable. And I just thank you for inviting me here today. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Can we ask you a couple questions?
Please, please.
The first thing that comes to mind, what role does our wife play in this?
Yeah.
I've been married 57 years. I have a wonderful wife. We work together. And it's an awesome relationship, but I'm not sure we really challenge each other. Any thoughts you have on that?
Yeah. Well, I'll say what we joke about, but I think our wives in healthy relationships are our greatest sanctifiers and sharpeners.
Yeah.
There's this beautiful passage in the book of Proverbs. If you want some really great reading on Proverbs, Dick has two books that I recommend. Proverbs says, as iron sharpens iron, so one runner sharpens another, or one man sharpens another, or one follower sharpens another. And so as much as Anvil is about forging men, we're not misogynistic. Men are the only leaders. You know, there is this hard and fast hierarchy. The complementarian nature of men and women in leadership and in relationship is a beautiful thing. And so I think our wives, if we're not being sharpened, if we're not being sanctified by that relationship, there's opportunity there.
And one thing I've found, and probably just applies to me, but if I can pause before I respond, things get much better. I've been married a long time and still find myself doing the same old things that light the same old fuses. Anybody else has that? That's just me. Okay.
No, I'm...
We'll erase that part out of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, your thoughts.
What are
some keys that you find in there?
Yeah, well, I'll say this. I don't know if all y'all are married, have been married, what your vows were at your wedding. Mm-hmm. I didn't say this as I stood across from Katie, but essentially, as we looked at each other and exchanged our rings and gave our vows, I gave her the permission of the hammer. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes those are the hardest blows to receive, because those are the spaces where I've also opened myself up and made myself most tender and most vulnerable. Yeah. And so it's hard to sometimes be shaped in those spaces. And the idea of, do I listen well? And after listening, am I humble enough to actually listen to what I hear and then put it into practice, I think? I think every relationship is different, right? And every woman is beautiful and complex. I think it's more of a posture of, am I willing to lead and in kindness and in care, do that same work in her life? And am I willing to receive that when it's needed in mine? I don't know. Dick's more the expert on marriage, so you can ask him on that one. Yeah, Gary.
My question has to do with your student body.
Yeah.
What percentage do you think come to you because they might already be troubled and they're brought by their parents to see if you can help?
Can you repeat the question for the...
Yeah, so the question, is, and it's a great question, in terms of the student body of the Anvil Academy, what is the makeup and how do we engage with boys who are troubled and need discipline versus boys who need formation? And it's a great question. What I really have appreciated is our board of directors has given us a really clear mandate and a really clear vision on that. So the nature of the Anvil Academy is that the boys are working with blades and knives, weapons, flames, tools. They're doing the things that when you were 13 and 14, you were doing because that's what our culture invited us to do. Now our 13 and 14-year-olds are given a joystick and said, go experience artificial danger on a screen. And I think this is the age of the boy that for thousands of years is when they would start to go into the workplace, into the marketplace, into the fields with their fathers and have real work with real responsibility and real consequence if it was done incorrectly. And I don't see that in today's culture. So that's what we're trying to create and provide. Now, who are we able to serve and who do we serve? We have a really lengthy interview process. We want to be able to serve any boy. But we recognize we're a pretty lean staff with limited resources. We ask two things of families when they interview. The first is, are we aligned with worldview? And when we say strong young men, are we talking about the same thing? And for us, it means the work of Jesus and the way of Jesus. The second piece for us is this right and appropriate for this boy? And so we're serving boys who are somewhere between 11 and 14. There are a number of boys who don't have the fine motor skills or the gross motor skills to be able to work with a 1,000-degree piece of steel and a hammer. It's just they're not ready from a musculature side. Those boys, we'll try to find a way to get them ready, and we want to serve them. We recognize that we're not able to serve boys who aren't there from a maturity side or a character side. And that's a hard piece because you want to be able to work with those boys who are really struggling. But we say it this way. We're not a reform school. We're a formation school. And so that's a really hard conversation when you have to look across the table at a parent and say, this isn't going to be a good fit for your son. But the promise that we make to every parent whose kids are there is that I'm not going to put a blade or a torch in the boy who's sitting 6 inches from your son if they're not ready for that. And so there, our student body, we're not necessarily working with troubled or delinquent or behavioral oppositional students, because this isn't the environment for them in terms of the structure. Now, that being said, we got a bunch of goofy, out of control middle school boys who need discipline and need discipleship and need shaping. And so all of them are in this wild season of life, and we're trying to create boundaries and guardrails in the midst of this wilderness season. But we say there's a pretty distinct difference between a developmentally appropriate immaturity for that season and a boy who is troubled or has really significant acute needs that we can't support.
One other question. Do you have a contract with the family?
We do. So there's several contracts. There's a tuition contract. So it is we're what's called a non-traditional educational center. And Don knows some of this. So we're able to do 60% of their core curriculum instruction. The two things that we don't do are their explicit math and their English language arts. And because of that, those families can go seek instruction that aligns with their students' needs. So we can serve boys who have extreme learning challenges, whether it be dyslexia or whether it be cognitive issues, where we couldn't serve them from a math or language arts side, but we can support and serve and teach them from a history, science, hands-on, hands-dirty space. But the parents sign the enrollment contract, which includes the tuition piece, as well as, I don't know, probably the longest waiver that a student ever has to sign before they come into a school. but I say this, we serve the student, but we partner with the parents. Right? The parents are where there's partnership, and we're supporting their raising of their kids. The way that we do that is by serving them on the school. So the boys come 2 days a week, either Tuesday, Thursday, or Wednesday and Friday. So they're with us 2 days. The other 3 days, they're working with other academic partners for their core subjects, or they're being homeschooled.
Just for a couple of minutes, could you share the board of directors end in mind that they have for Anvil Academy?
Big picture is that we influence and support a whole generation of strong young men who will be leaders in their families and in communities and industries. And so that's why we exist, for the sake of forging healthy men who will be the next leaders of this country. And I don't think it's too small to say the power right now of 114 boys. You think about the ripple of that every year for however long, I think we'll make an impact. But the reality is right now we have a wait list. That is, we could open another school tomorrow. The desire for this and need for this within this region and community, we can't support that. And so there's really two goals that the board of directors has. The first is that, one, how do we create a place of permanence here in Cumming? So Forsyth County has been amazing. And right now we operate in a barn that we renovated on our property. We have a 5-acre piece of land over here. And we've renovated that space, and we've had a conditional use permit and a temporary CO for the last 8 years. Forsyth County is wonderful, but they say, if you're going to run a school and call it a school, you need to create a space that meets all of the same life safety and code and ordinances that West High School has, which I agree with 100%, but it's an incredibly expensive and lengthy investment to do this. So we're in the process of a capital campaign to be able to build what we call a place of permanence, a barn raising. We talked about the Amish. So my parents live in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, right in the midst of these four Amish farms. Right down the road is the one-room Amish schoolhouse that the kids go to. It's we love going there. And we got a chance about 5 years ago to actually see an Amish barn raising happening. We were driving by and we saw there must have been 200 people here on this in this community, and they were in the process of putting up this structure, a whole community coming together to build this. And it was amazing to see. And it really gave me a vision for what would it look like for a community to come together and build a school, have a barn raising here. Now, Forsyth County won't let us get a bunch of ropes and raise a barn in an afternoon. But you'll see if you drive down Campground Road, our fence that was there just came down. And we're going to be breaking ground in about 2 months on a barn that will be the place of permanence for these boys. And it'll be able to serve 120 students, and that'll be our fully built-out model. So that's part one of the vision. The second part is that we recognize the day that we open that new barn, we'll already have the waiting list for the next campus. And so we're actively looking to create and plan Anvil Academies all throughout the region, not for the sake of getting bigger or multiplying so that we can be organizationally larger. It's for the sake of creating a space in every community, a micro-learning space where a group of families can come together and say, we desire this for our boys. And so North Forsyth or Dawsonville is actually currently where we're exploring a campus that will beta launch in the fall of 25 with 40 students. And over the course of 3 years, we'll grow from 40 to 80 to 120. And once that's built out, we have a space over in Woodstock and Canton that we're looking at. And then we see ourselves moving down into the Roswell area. But, boy, it's expensive down there. But we believe that multiplication through giving this to other like-minded learning communities is going to be the future of these micro-learning communities and the future of the Anvil Academy. And so, yeah, thanks for asking about that.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, one more question? Yeah.
You've been at this a few years. Success stories?
Yeah. Oh, I love talking. Thanks, Don, for asking that. So we just this week started our eighth year. And when we first started, we were 5th through 8th grade, and then we moved to 6th through 8th grade. But our first group of 5th graders who started back in 2016 just graduated this past year, and we had graduates in almost every high school in Forsyth, wow, at Creekview, in Cherokee, and a number in Fulton. And to see these goofy boys, you know, who went through Anvil and experienced the Anvil model, to see who they've become and where they're going. We have boys who are going into the military academies. We have boys who are going to University of Georgia, to Auburn, to Samford. We have boys who have started their businesses entrepreneurially. We have a boy who started a welding company and is making more than I'm making as a 18-year-old in a welding company. I mean, you see these success stories. We had a boy who passed away. We had a boy who, in his junior year of high school, developed bone cancer, and after a long fight, passed away. And the success story was that at his funeral, a whole group of Anvil boys who hadn't seen each other from graduation came together and said, we're going to choose to be here. They came in their Anvil uniforms. And at the funeral, the last thing his dad said from the stage was he said, I know where Aiden is because at the Anvil Academy, he was taught to live pure, speak true, right, wrong, and follow the king. And to the best of his ability, he followed the king in his own way up until the day he died. And I remember talking to my friend who was there, and I said, if that's the only story we ever hear, this is worth it. But it's not the only story. There's several hundred of them that are playing out, and I love being able to watch them as they go and see the men that they're becoming.
Do you have a website?
I do. So on the business card that's there is my contact information. There's also a website. You can scan it with a QR code, or you can go. It's theandelacademy.org.
Okay, good.
Please reach out. And if you want to come take a tour, I would love to show you around. If this is something that engages your heart and you want to be a partner with us, whether it be financially or from a discipleship side, please reach out.
Awesome.
We're always looking for men who want to invest in the next generation.
You all need to go one day and walk around the campus and see them in action with Andrew.
Yeah, so if you drive past, there's no sign that says the Anvil Academy, and that's on purpose.
Yeah.
There's 13 acres that we've pieced together back there, and these boys are in classrooms, workshops, forges, kind of spread throughout the campus. But for both their safety and to honor the fact that our neighbors are there in somewhat of a residential area, we try to stay as low-key as possible within that space. And to have it reflect the aesthetic of a farm, barn, home space.
Where is it again?
So, 7591 Campground Road.
Okay.
And if you go to the website, all the addresses there. But if you take post, write down, I forget what.
Bentley.
Bentley to Campground, we're pretty much right there. Thank you for the chance to be with you all today.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Awesome. Thank you. And we pass along the word about this meeting to others, other men, invite a neighbor. And we'll have this information on the website so you can listen to it again or pass it along to other people. So thank you for coming, and you're an encouragement to me to keep this thing going, so we'll see you in 3 months.